Welcome to a new episode of The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for The Catbird Seat, the White Sox blog for the ESPN Sweet Spot Network. This podcast is available on iTunes. Just search for The Catbird Speaks on iTunes and subscribe so you don't have to do that again. It'll just appear to you. At least I think that's how podcast subscriptions work. Joining me today is just Nick Schaefer in Manhattan. Is that New York or Kansas?
If it were the Kansas one, you'd hear me palling around with Primiano a lot more than I tend to.
Joining you today in Elkhart is me, James Fegan. The off season is still trucking along, kind of. Well, I guess when's the last time the White Sox made a move? Like the Todd Frazier trade, was that pretty much? I mean, they signed Albers. Matt Albers.
Yep.
So that was like a week and a half ago.
Was Albers their first transaction since Frazier?
I think so.
Other than, I don't know, Rule 5, deck shuffling a little bit.
Did they acquire anyone in Rule 5 or just lose someone?
That's a really good question. I wish I had looked this up before we started. But I can pull it up rather quickly.
I would say Frazier is the last acquisition that changed our conception of how good the team is.
That's certainly true. You know, Albers is nice, but he's hardly, you know, you're making maybe marginal adds at your third or fourth right-handed reliever. It's not that big a deal. So the last transaction I see listed here on ESPN, well, they claimed Jerry Sands on the 23rd of December.
Changed their destination, I guess.
Okay, so they got some ARB. They had some ARB deals with Abascal, Putnam, Jennings, and Lurie.
I don't know if I'm counting those.
All the non-roster invites, Albers, minor league personnel shifts, and then the last would be claiming Daniel Fields then off of waivers. So that, yeah, no, that's it hasn't been much.
So basically since December 16th, we've been sitting around kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop or the last slot to fill?
Yeah. I would say so. I'm sure anybody listening to this has already heard me 1,000 times gradually just moving down the list of preferred options in right field as they were slowly taken off the table, like an agonizingly slowly taken off the table. And now we're left with me hoping for Dexter Fowler, bracing myself for, you know, I've talked myself into being very okay with Austin Jackson, if that's what they do. And failing that, being very sad.
So that's a solid, like, month and a half. We've just been kind of pining.
Yeah.
You could kind of say there's probably been some off seasons where between mid-November and the start, like New Year's Day, where the lion's share or the vast majority of all off-season moves have been made. And we spent that long just kind of, like, waiting for one.
Yeah, and it started out so eventfully. I mean, the hardest things I thought going into this offseason would be addressing third. I'd even talk myself into saying, you know, if you fix some of the other problems that you could live with Sanchez at second base.
Yeah, that wasn't really a top priority for me that needed to be addressed. I mean, he had stretches where he was definitely a major league player.
Yeah, it, if you feel like he's a really strong glove and he can OPS, I don't know, between 650 and 700, you can live with that if the rest of your team is good. And there were real questions about that. But then all of a sudden you have probably an above average bat at second base and a below average glove in Lurie. And you have now a plus glove and plus bat at third base. And that looked like the hardest thing to do, and they just solved those things with relative ease pretty early on. And then it was just, okay, great, there's now this absurd boatload of outfielders out there, and that's all they need to do. Like, how hard could this be? And then 6 weeks later, the roster's the same. Minus Trace.
Yeah, minus Trace, who... I'd feel better if he were here. So right now we kind of have some rumors, but we're at a stage where we've gone through so many like percolations and the White Sox kicking the tires on this guy. It's hard to really say these stand out in terms of seriousness over previous things we've kind of reviewed and kicked around.
Yeah, and there's an element now also of, well, you know, if it hasn't happened already, why am I paying attention to a rumor? You know, at this point, I'm confused as to what could possibly change. You know, what's could possibly change in Dexter Fowler's market at this stage? I mean, is Fowler waiting for someone to get hurt in spring training to sign? Is he waiting for after the season to start? You know, some of these, and if the White Sox have already decided they're not interested in Fowler because they don't want to lose the draft pick, how come they haven't already pulled the trigger on a plan B? I'm just confused as to the timetable on it. Because if you've already made up your mind, we do not want to give up a draft pick, okay, then that means that there's only a few options. That narrows your options even further. So it should be easier to choose.
I mean, if a charitable interpretation of the offseason is that the White Sox were indeed competing for, say, Alex Gordon and Yoenis Cespedes, and simply had a situation where they were either outbid or were on equal footing and those guys opted to go home, possibly even for somewhat less, I'm not really open to the idea that the White Sox just crazily blew away other offers and these guys, out of the goodness, their love of Queens and Kansas City, went home.
Right, and Cespedes was there for what, 10 weeks?
10 great weeks, but...
Yeah, but I don't know. The thing is, you can't really... If you tell me that the White Sox beat the Mets' offer to Cespedes, I just don't believe you. If you think the White Sox outbid what the Royals offered for Gordon... I don't believe you. I just, there was nowhere that we read that the White Sox were offering 480 for Gordon or were offering Cespedes the highest annual contract for an outfielder of all time. So maybe they made similar offers or comparable, or, you know, maybe the White Sox offered Cespedes something like the Nats, you know, hey, you, to Cespedes, where hey, you can get some a few more years here, but there's lower value, and you're not going to get back on the market while you're anywhere close to your prime. And Cespedes obviously prefers, hey, I'll just take a ton of money for 1 year, opt out, or if the market's not looking great, come back in after a ton more money in 3 years. If they offered a competitive thing and they went back to the two teams that were in the World Series last year, okay. I get that, but I think that that narrative has really been overblown, and there's no, I haven't heard any reason to believe that the White Sox made even a competitive offer, because I know the White Sox are secretive, but when you make an offer, you communicate it to a third party, and there's, you know, Alex Gordon's agent could have leaked that just as easily as anybody. He's got no reason to keep secrets for the White Sox unless they will, you know, throw a tantrum and refuse to work with you ever again.
I guess my point would be that Han kind of tacitly admitted that he was competing for these guys during SoxFest and, you know, kind of gave the explanation of these guys wanted to return home to some degree. He definitely made allusions to that. He obviously kind of is always very careful with his words. He's never like an open book about it, but he kind of made those allusions that allowed you to put those pieces together. That would inherently indicate that the White Sox are not operating on some level where they can't expand their payroll to $135 million, or it's currently estimated at like $120 if you put all the minimum salaries they have to put together on Baseball Reference. To be competitive for Cespedes and competitive for Gordon, that would mean that the idea of expanding their payroll to that ceiling has already been to some degree cleared. It's just a question of, is it still worth it for them to do that for Fowler? Or is it when the market came down to the Fowler level of talents that require them to go and reassess the trade market? Was that kind of the directive from ownership? Or is that just a general feeling that if we're going to have to pay and give out a draft pick, it behooves us to kind of see if we can just simply accomplish this without pushing up our payroll or without giving up the 28th pick, which it seems like they value probably more than I would like.
Yeah, and the 28th pick, I've done a lot of arguing on Twitter about why they should be willing to part with it, and I don't want to give the idea that I just think it's worthless and you should just throw it away, because it does affect your cap, and the more bites at the apple you get in the top 30, 40 picks, the better your chances of getting something that sticks. And we've seen how valuable that can be, because for about 15 years, we saw an organization trying to succeed without it. And we've started to see players come up from the minors again for the first time in forever and contribute. And we've seen how nice that is. So, you know, the 28th pick is nothing to sneeze at. It's nothing to just throw away on a whim. But at the same time, I think people vastly overestimate the success rate of back-end first-round picks. I think that, you know, I've pointed out the 28th pick, and people come back to me and say, like, well, Mike Trout and every other guy who's ever been drafted after that point has been a huge success. And that's just, you know, the sample people are using is the most successful outcomes for all of those draft picks, and then like working backwards from there.
Here's a good primer on approaching the value of draft picks. Do not anticipate drafting Mike Trout.
And I enjoyed your pronunciation of primer.
I've always gone to primer.
No,
they said primer in the movie Contact in like 1996, like, and I've been doing it ever since.
Like Trout, for any purposes, for any sort of, you can't draw any conclusions from Trout. He's maybe the best player of all time when everything's at the end of, you know, done. But regardless, yeah, they might be doing that reevaluation, like you said. Like they had plans A, B, and C fall through, and now they're looking at plan D and thinking, oh geez, maybe there's something else we can come up with. That's, you know, that's possible. And Han is a really smart guy, and it already behooves GMs to be coy. And this is an organization that tries to be even more coy than all the other ones, with some success, I suppose. And the fact that that narrative was already, that already had a ton of traction, that Cespedes and Gordon just wanted to go back to their prior teams. If it's that easy for him to just play into that, you know, this guy went to Harvard Law. Like, he's going to take that opportunity if he can.
And he's also a Michigan man, Nick. So I don't know.
And the Cespedes thing too, for everyone to be like, well, he really wanted to go back to New York. Like that was what he wanted to do all along. Unless you think that the Mets offering him 2 to 3 years at the beginning of the offseason and him very publicly saying, oh, forget you guys, and walking away from the table and then fielding offers from like all of Major League Baseball for 2 months before eventually coming back to the Mets. If that indicates to you, man, he just really wanted to come to the Mets all along. It seems like wishful thinking. Fans like to think that players are making decisions for the same reasons that, you know, oh, because he likes the team I root for best. And just, that's usually not the case. It's usually just who's making the best offer. And make no mistake, the Mets gave Cespedes by far the best offer that we heard of from everybody. So
I'm sure, or I could be convinced, that Yoan Cespedes wanted to return to the Mets all along, perhaps. I don't think he was married to it. Like,
if the White Sox offered him the same deal that Upton got, doesn't he take that?
Probably. I mean, I think of it more in terms of, like, I'm driving home from work. I'm really hungry. I want to get Wendy's. I pull up and there's 6 cars in line in the drive-thru. I don't want to do it that much. And I'm, like, gone.
Right. And also, to show how silly some of these narratives have gotten. And, you know, you can twist the evidence to support the theory, but that's all you're really doing is you're taking the little pieces that fit and ignoring the ones that don't. And there's no way to really prove it one way or the other. But a narrative that emerged was, Justin Upton just didn't want to play in Chicago. I don't know where that comes from. Like, the dude signed in Detroit. So I can't imagine any sort of negative thing you could say about Chicago that isn't really like also true more so of Detroit. And even saying, well, if he wants to go to a winner, The White Sox were better than the Tigers last year.
And their current, like, when he signed, they had a stronger roster than the Tigers had.
Yeah. So, it's like, just be careful about what, listeners, not you, James, but listeners, just be careful.
I'll be careful, too.
You should be. By the way, I'm looking at, just at 2010 draft, to my point earlier, and I'm looking at, like, the outfielders who were drafted in the back half of the first round. Not dripping with all-stars, James, back here. We're looking at Gary Brown, who I don't think has ever... Has he made the majors?
I think he might have gotten a September call-up, but more of like a... You be a fast guy who plays off outfield defense situation rather than...
You got Kyle Parker.
We think you can hit.
We have someone named Chevy Clark. I don't know. Nothing really here. Zach Cox, you remember him? Like Brett Walls Jr.?
I remember the name Zach Cox.
Yep.
It's interesting that Upton, you know, kind of in the wake of Hayward signing with the Cubs, he gave quotes that really made him come somewhat unpopular with St. Louis fans that kind of like bought into the idea of, oh, he was, you know, the Cubs were the ideal fit for him. This is where he wanted to go, and other places wouldn't be as good as this situation. And it was something about more than money. And, you know, I'm open to the idea that it's a factor. Him saying that the Cubs are a young core and he didn't want to have to be stuck as a team going through an overhaul because all its talent is, you know, aging. Justin Upson comes along and just says, sign me up for that experience, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, he can opt out in 2 years.
He can. Well, when can Hayward opt out? Not much soon after that.
Well, and if they're still good, and he can always use the next opt out if he doesn't use the first one,
right?
So, yeah, you know, I don't want to fall too far into the camp of pretending that these aren't human beings and that they don't care about anything but the finances. But I'd like to think that, you know, a lot of these organizations are similar in a lot of ways. And, you know, you could say, well, he went to the Cubs because he wanted to be in a winner. Like, what, like the Cardinals don't just, like, relentlessly win constantly? Like, he would have been fine either way.
Yeah, that farm system is not, like, reviled or anything.
No, and even if it were, part of that's because they've, like, graduated multiple all-stars to the Major League roster in the last, like, 2 years.
It's not like Hayward was like also said like, you know, Steven Piscotty's like first year success is totally unsustainable. So that's why I was really out of there.
Like Colton Wong isn't a prospect anymore. No, because he's an amazing second baseman. Yeah. So, you know, I think that you need to balance those concepts. And I think people swing way too hard for the soft factors that don't make a ton of, I think they overemphasize that. So tying it back to the White Sox, we don't know what offers were actually made to any of those guys, if any. So, you know, I can't say one way or the other. I mean, if it came out after this that the White Sox offered Alex Gordon 5 years, $100 million, yeah, I would say he just really wanted to stay in Kansas City. But we don't know that. We all we heard was a 3-year limit, which was then, you know, that was contradicted explicitly by Han, and whether or not his contradiction is true or not, we don't know.
It really behooved Han to kind of go out and dispel that. I think like on an individual, like negotiation level, maybe taking the hard stance of we're not going in 3 years when you're in like conversations with a particular prospect, or a particular target is probably, you know, it has some benefit to it. I think having the concluding theme of the offseason, after all the dust has settled, being that the White Sox didn't get anyone because they didn't go 3 years beyond 3 years for anybody, would not be a very good, like, that would be something you want to stomp out publicly.
Yeah, but the problem is, and I'm very much on the skeptical side, and Han might be telling the truth. Maybe they were extremely flexible.
I think he is. I just think he needed to say that too.
But it would also be very easy to say that even if it were the truth. It'd be very easy afterwards, because what? Like, are any of those guys gonna come out after the fact and be like, I know that, you know, yeah, the White Sox only offered me 3 years, but I know they would have gone more. I just got this better. You know, there's no way. It's a very easy claim to make.
That doesn't benefit them to kind of like take on the White Sox for some reason.
No. So like I said, it's very easy for Han to say that whether or not it's true. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But you're right. It was clearly, at least the portion of White Sox Twitter that I can see was unhappy with that. So there is still, I mean, there's still options out there. Obviously, I still think I've always liked Fowler as a player, especially seeing him continue to do his thing outside of Coors. There was there was reason to believe that his defense had actually improved due to his positioning over the course of last season, and that his glove is fine in center, not even below average, but like fine. And certainly he'd be a plus in a corner.
Yeah, Mauro Rubio from 2080 Baseball, friend of the blog, has been pretty consistent that Fowler is average defensively. He's a big plus athlete. He's a good runner. And he basically doesn't get very good reads, but can compensate with speed. That will be something that will decline as he gets into his 30s. But the positioning angle part of that, I think John Arguello at Cubs Den had something early in the season about it, was that Fowler admitted to early in his career being a guy who kind of played shallow, trying to think that his athleticism could allow him to backpedal and cover a lot of ground. But
right.
If you're a guy who doesn't get good reads, the fact that you're a plus athlete, he kind of possibly was overextending himself with that kind of strategy, and the Cubs moved him back. And, you know, I don't like UZR at all, let alone one-year samples, but if the big argument against Fowler is that, look at his career UZR, it's bad, well, the Cubs made an adjustment, and last year he had a good UZR. So there's some sort of suggestive evidence there that something good could be happening.
And logically, if he's making mistakes, you know, if you're going to miss something, you'd rather miss it in front of you than behind you. So if that positioning change would be reassuring to me.
Fowler was such a revered athlete coming out that I think there was a lot of shock initially when his defensive metrics didn't match up with kind of a lot of the scouting fear of this big 6'5" guy who runs very well. This should be very rangy.
But also, I mean, even just looking at when you say the UZR, I mean, you're looking from year to year. It's like an every other year thing. Either he's average in center or he's like vastly below. And to me, what that indicates is I'm not looking at UZR. That's what I take away from that.
That's probably the safest result, especially someone who played in the massive, massive outfield of Coors Field.
Yeah.
Where I once watched Brett Lillibridge playing center allow Troy Tulowitzki to score on a single from first base.
I don't know what you're talking about. Brett Lillibridge, I watched one game that he played in the outfield, and he looked like the best defensive outfielder of all time. So
yeah, in right field.
Yeah. Man, when I was screaming for Brett Lillibridge to get more playing time.
He deserved it.
He did. He was better than the other guys they were using.
Subterranean Alex Rios is his counterpart that year.
He was better on both sides of the ball than like every other outfielder on the team.
He was also better at first base than Adam Dunn that year. Which is hilarious because he's like half the size of Rios and Dunn, and he
had an 845 OPS that
squirting around the field and put in the machine.
He was a plus glove at a lot of positions. He had an OPS of 845, and then he OPS'd. Oh God, what did he hit for the rest of his career?
Not high.
524 in 2012, and then 394 in 2013, and then out of baseball.
I think he hit more home runs in 2011 than LaRoche hit last year, or just as many.
He hit 13.
And how many did LaRoche have?
Did he have 14? No, because Eden had 14 in a second. LaRoche had 12. Good memory. Also, Lillibridge hit 19 home runs in his whole career and 13 for that one season.
Including some total bombs.
Yeah, he was crushing. So weird.
So speaking of studs, is Andre Ethier playing D for the White Sox?
I had remembered that he had played center field recently, but he played 500 innings of center field in 2014. He only played one inning in center last year. Yeah, I mean,
I feel like in general, people did not have memories of Andre Ethier. People did not seem to make a lot of new memories of Andre Ethier last year. Because, like, I think when, like, the Phil Rogers, like, tweet came out, there was a lot of people who said, like, oh, I hope he can bounce back. I was like, Andre Ethier was, you know, with all the Andre Ethier limitations, had a good Andre Ethier season in 2015.
Yeah, they protected him from lefties, and his line looks really good.
Yeah, he has an absurd split, not just for, like, last season, for his career. He's, like, a 74 weighted runs created against left-handed pitching, and 140 against right-handed.
Yeah. Yeah, he goes from, like, he's, like, Jose Abreu against righties, and then he's, like, Carlos Sanchez against lefties. It's, yeah. It's impressive. I wrote a little bit of, we both wrote a little bit about this today. Presumably, you would trade for Ethier because you prefer that to signing Fowler, right? Because otherwise you would just sign Fowler if you preferred that, correct?
Right.
So, if you would, that means you're either trying to save money or save talent in the form of the draft pick. Because Ethier is pretty expensive.
Right.
He has a $38 million guaranteed commitment over the next 3 years and a vesting option that would mean another, I think it's $17.5 or $18.5 million for the third year moving forward. So that'd be 2018. You also have to trade for the guy. It's not like Ethier's a free agent at that price. Like, you would need to send them something, like a player. And I think going back to what I was saying about the 28th pick getting misvalued in conversations that I've seen, like, even a middling prospect at the upper levels is probably a better outcome than what you're going to get from the 28th pick. Like, I think Trey Michalczewski would be my, like, example, where he was a 7th-round pick, granted with, like, a 3rd-round bonus, and he's had, like, a really good outcome, and he's going to be, what, double-A next year?
Yes.
So, and his ceiling is probably, like, an average third baseman, and that's probably better than what you would get with the 28th pick. So I'd just rather, you know, them stop screwing around, because, like, Fowler's average salary, there's no way he commands an AAV higher than what Ethier is going to get the next 2 years. And the draft pick is probably not going to yield a better player if you're sending a prospect over. So unless you're talking about the Dodgers, like, paying all of Ethier's salary, in which case you're probably going to have to send better talent over. I just don't see the point on the spectrum where money and talent combined, you're coming out better than just signing Fowler.
I think Ethier might have a stronger 1 to 2 year ceiling. I think you could possibly make the case of Ethier has the potential to just come over, have a really big year against right-handed pitching, and have a big boost to the offense as you're really just trying to, like, jack the offensive up for the next 2 years. Whereas with Fowler, I really like Fowler because of how stable he is. I think... Yeah. It's going to be really hard for Fowler to just have a garbage year. He's too good of a runner. He's too useful a defender, both in center and corner. His walk rate is so stable, he's going to get on base, even if, like, there's something wrong with his wrist and his power goes. Whereas if that happens to Ethier, he's kind of worthless to you. It's going to be really hard for Fowler to have, like, a year as bad as, like, what Melky Cabrera did last year. He's someone who I would have a lot of confidence holding up over a 2 to 3 year deal. More than the average, you know, big, bad acquisition. He's just a really stable buy. At this point, he's not the huge sea change to your offense that the other three options were, like Cespedes, Gordon, Upton. But he's just, like, a fairly sensible purchase.
Yep. And the downside with Ethier is pretty bad. I don't know. Even if you, like, Fowler could beat Ethier in on-base percentage next year while playing, you know, facing both, while getting 600-plus plate appearances instead of hiding him so that he only gets, like, 450.
This is true.
And then you factor in the glove, and then you factor in base running and roster flexibility, because somebody's going to have to take those plate appearances that Ethiers can't against lefties. And presumably you're going to have to be able to make that swap mid-game frequently because everybody's got freaking lefties in the bullpen. So I don't know. I get the Ethier thing in the sense that I get adding pretty much any outfielder because every single outfielder in baseball is better than Avisail Garcia. But it just seems like deliberately taking the more difficult option for reasons I don't understand.
Fowler's platoon splits are somewhat pronounced, but I kind of like them with Adam Eaton because you can't just like attack the start of that lineup. Or I guess if you bring in a Lugie for it, he has to only be Adam Eaton because you can't just like you're going to attack the top of the lineup with a lefty and have him face Dexter Fowler, who has a .392 career on base percentage against left-handed pitching, and
yeah,
Jose Abreu.
There is a platoon split there, but it's not as big as you might think. I mean,
I'm sorry, I quoted his 2015 platoon split, not his career.
Yeah, that was big, but for his career, he's an .829 OPS against lefties versus a .761 OPS against righties. So yeah, like he hits lefties better, but he doesn't like fall apart against right-handed pitching. Certainly not to the degree that you would like. You could just run him out there and never play platoon games with him and you'll be fine. You'll be just fine. I mean, he's not Austin Jackson where it's like he's literally exactly the same against both, but he still doesn't put that like massive strain on the rest of your roster that Ethier would.
Yeah, I mean, as you were pointing out, and I kind of noted, if you have Ethier, say, oh great, now Avisail Garcia is a platoon outfielder. It's not particularly great since he's barely above average against left-handed pitching and he's still kind of an atrocious defender who gets thrown out trying to steal bases all the time.
Yep.
But now, obviously, I can't help with the Adam LaRoche situation, which I don't know what you do. Maybe you have to carry Jerry Sands on the roster, which could have some benefits offensively, but the guy really doesn't have a solid position. He's not really much better defensively than Avisail. And
no.
Then you got... how do you stack the rest of your infield depth? You kind of just have Carlos Sanchez, I guess.
You'd basically have to say, all right, Lurie Garcia, you're backing up every single position, like a lot. Because if you're using two roster spots on guys who have zero defensive utility and cannot hit lefties, that just like that puts such a strain on the rest of your bench.
Do you use Deonor Navarro a lot? Robin didn't really feel comfortable burning his backup catcher for, you know, platoon help very much last season with Gianni Soto. So I don't really know if that's going to change.
Yeah, no, I don't see, you know, if Robin was willing to do that, he would have done it last year.
Frankly, just thinking about it now, the idea of pulling out Alex Avila's defensive replacement during a game sounds kind of terrifying.
I mean, I guess what you could do is, you know, you pinch hit him and then maybe you surrender the DH for the late game situations.
Great.
You pinch hit and then you like sub, you know, Navarro back behind the plate and bench Avila. But then if something happens to Navarro, then you're like, what? Who's, do you forfeit? Like, what do you do?
I would like some inventive strategy, but I guess I can't think of surrender the DH seeming like a good regular thing to fall back on.
No, and if you've got like, I mean, I don't know how much you're banking on like Rick Renteria picking up the in-game tactics if you're going to give them this, you know, puzzle to solve for 162 games, because the coaching staff that I saw last year had a few important strengths, which was, and this was driven home. You could contrast this to the Matt Williams situation with the Nationals. It's clear that Robin Ventura communicates very well with his players. They love playing for him. He has like a very calm demeanor. He seems like a funny guy from what I was hearing from SoxFest. And I'm sure you guys will hear more from Kat Garcia on that topic, but in-game strategy is not his strength, to put it that way. To make him deal with an AL roster that prominently features Andre Ethier and Adam LaRoche to save I don't know, what, $15 million 3 years from now on Fowler, or to like save the number 28 pick. Like, this just seems like making your life way harder than it has to be.
Yeah.
Like, and why are they freaking out so much about contracts 3 or 4 years down the road when they have zero money committed 3 or 4 years down the road? Like, I understand that they, you know, they're worried about Sale coming up for free agency and some other issues like that. And, you know, maybe Sale is still the same Sale 3 years from now, and you want to ink him for like an 8 year, $300 million deal or whatever the hell he'll be worth. But A, you're speculating as to what sort of situation he'll be in then. And B, Danks and LaRoche are the only like bad money you have committed, or maybe Melky if you really hate Melky. And those guys are all gone after 2 years. Why are we so scared of the like third and fourth year of these deals?
Sale free agency or Quintana or a Brave free agency is such like a trigger word for me. It like sets my hair on edge that to even like care about those years that are no guarantee that you'll even want Sale in free agency 3 years from now. I mean, I think he's one of the greatest pitcher I've ever seen in the White Sox uniform, but maybe his arm is completely gone. We need to worry about the years that we have that they have Sale under contract right now, because that's way more valuable just inherently than Sale in 3 years is going to be.
Sure.
And you're already paying for it, so try to get a return on your investment.
Yeah, and it's just weird. I mean, and you can say, oh, no, but like Sale is just that great. And, you know, I love Chris Sale, but I don't know. Miguel Cabrera is, what, a Hall of Famer, right? And the Tigers started worrying about his free agency 2 years too early. And now they look like they have like an organization sinking contract on their hands. I mean,
I would have thought, but man, they just keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, they've identified that they have a winning core potentially, and they're going to try to exploit it. It's I don't know how many times they have to kick the White Sox teeth in before the White Sox notice, but
as someone who is like, very like on purpose has like tries to have very little sympathy for the idea that owners would need to go into the red to invest to get a return on their investment, I still look at Detroit's contract and commitments and go, oh my God, really? Like, I can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, they got some really they got a lot of bad issues in terms of that, and I'm not recommending, like, you know, destroying the future of your organization the way that the Tigers may have done. But suggesting that they sign a guy like a modest deal guy like Dex, because Fowler, this is something that I responded to a reader on earlier today. He was asking, what do you think Fowler would command? And here's my thought process, and let me know what you think of it. I mean, the Fowler almost certainly should get 4 years. I think that you'd have to offer him a lot of money or an opt-out or something for three. I just don't see why he would want to do that. You know, he can point to Denard Span and be like, I'm better than that dude. Give me 4 years. And he's not as good as Alex Gordon. So that sort of caps where he can, you know, his asking price. So I would think 4 years and, you know, because Gordon got 472, right?
I believe so.
So Fowler, I would think, would get somewhere between 448 and 460. And that's kind of a big range, but that's sort of what I have in my head for him.
I mean, it's basically just saying 4 years in between 12 to 15 AAV, so I don't think it's that big a range.
Okay, but do you think I'm undershooting it? Do you think I'm overshooting it? Like,
what I would have pegged it at going at the start of the offseason. Maybe 448, I think, would be like a low start to the range at the start of the offseason. At this point, with it hard to really assess whether or not this is just a new era of slow play in free agency and whether or not his market is actually cratered due to how long it's lasted and how many, you know, people who would normally be in on him, teams that are normally in on him, are now off the board. So I might even slide it a bit. I guess I wouldn't go below 48 for 4 years. I think if he's below 48 total value, he's probably taking 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would think that'd be a fair idea to peg it. But then again, if something crazy, if it turns out, yes, the reason he's still on the board is because, like, there's only the Rangers, the White Sox, and the very half-interested, if that at all, Cubs are still in on him, then that wouldn't be super shocking.
I mean, Span got 10.3 years, $31 million, coming off of a couple pretty brutal in, like, Span is a nice player, and I like Span a lot, but he's just, he's always hurt. And it's kind of scary things, like it's a hip, it's a...
Hip labrum surgery is not a minor thing for a guy who gets by on athleticism a lot.
Yeah, he's a speed-based dude. And, you know, he's a guy who had significant concussion issues for a while, too. And we've seen what that can do to people's careers. I mean, Fowler's... And Fowler maybe is pretty much the same guy... Maybe not as good defensively. Maybe yes, maybe no.
I would say definitely not.
So you think Span is plus in center?
Or at least his reputation is staked on being plus in center. I mean, I don't know about
him. Because there was a while where...
Hip labrum surgery, but...
There was a while where his reputation, I think, was less good, and then somehow, oddly, it got better. But anyway, regardless, they're very similar in many respects. Except Fowler's 2 years younger and a lot healthier. So, to me, if Span could get, coming off his 31 season with hip labrum surgery, could get 331, 448 seems like you're getting a pretty good deal on Fowler, in my opinion.
I would have cheered it at the beginning of the offseason, besides the whole part about wanting better players.
So why are they so scared of, I don't know, why are they so scared of that? Like, what's... What does that do? Like, by the way, if you sign him to 448, or even let's say you sign him to 460, and you just it's $15 million for all 4 years, and you don't backload it at all, that puts you a little over, maybe like I think that would put you somewhere between $5 and like $8 million over the cost of the 2011 team. Like, why were they willing to do that in 2011, but now they're not, when the team's, like, better? It's very strange.
I mean, it's hard to really conclude that they're scared or not doing it until... I mean, there's not even a team I would identify as being farther along with Fowler that the White Sox need to, like, throw their bid in. Like, there's nothing going on with him. Like, the report from David Kaplan this week that, like, the Rangers and White Sox are talking to him was, like, the most we've heard about him in weeks, and the White Sox were at the forefront of it. So until it's, you know, free agency and negotiations, and especially with the White Sox, is such a black box that I really can't conclude about anything they're doing at the present time. I can only look at their record of having never signed a major free agent and say, well, this is a pattern at this point, and look at the payrolls and say, well, this clearly there's a ceiling that, you know, they haven't gone beyond $130 million. Or much beyond it ever.
I think what 2011 was the highest opening day payroll commitment, and it was just under $128 million.
So yeah, there you go.
And the revenues have obviously gone up since then. As much as, like, even if you just take the $25 million that, like, every single team gets that was added, I think last year or the year before. So, you know, slap that on top, and you got room for. Got room for Fowler and Desmond and, you know, all their friends. But
That's a good segue with Ian Desmond.
Yeah. I don't really care if they... I kind of prefer if they didn't sign him. How do you feel?
I am so much more invested in the outfield situation. I think there's so much more potential for a strong upgrade just by getting a decent, solid regular. And I think Ian Desmond is more of like... a bounce-back candidate, but I think, you know, Ian Desmond of last season is not... I mean, Tyler Saladino is a very light-hitting player, but he's not a huge upgrade from what Saladino was, and certainly not what the optimistic projections for Saladino's bat are. So if Ian Desmond just, like, you know, continues his decline, you really don't come anywhere near justifying that kind of expense with both money and a draft pick. And no, I think just the outfielder is just a clear, solid buy, and I'm under no delusion that I'm possibly have the White Sox signing both players, so I would be strongly against, like, spending, like, their last major allocation for Ian Desmond for something that's more of a potential upgrade over outfield, which seems clear and cut, dried, guaranteed, three wins added if you do something.
Anything. Like, I think Austin Jackson could even be a three-win upgrade on Avisail. Because I assume Austin Jackson in a corner is going to play really good defense, and he's probably going to hit about the same as Avisail would. And we saw how bad the defense was last year. We can get back to that later. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, to me, Saladino, if the organization believes he can field the position well, field shortstop well, then, frankly, like, he doesn't really need to do much else. He probably won't. But, like you said, so right now Steamer has Saladino projected next year for a weighted run created plus of 80. I don't know if that's
which would
optimistic.
Be a big leap forward from last year.
Yeah, yeah, it would.
And he wasn't exactly young.
Nope. But Ian Desmond last year had a weighted run created plus of 83.
Right.
So, I mean, and I never really loved Desmond's glove at short. Like, his bat kind of always justified his existence there, and now he doesn't hit anymore. So, like you said, Desmond's young enough and was pretty good once upon a time. But his profile was always, he never really had any on-base skills. And that always scared me where, you know, getting like a ton of base hits and hitting for a lot of power, he's not really doing anything for you. And his K rate has just been it's just been steadily climbing for 4 years in a row now. Like,
yeah.
He struck out 29% of the time last year. And 28% the year before. Like, this looks like the new normal for him. And
normal's bad.
And, right, if you're sitting there with Desmond and Fowler right there, I mean, Saladino is already a better option at short than Avisail is in right. And if you look at those two things and you think, oh, geez, we're going with Desmond, we're not on the same page. I don't understand. I guess, like, Saladino and Avisail are the weakest starters on the team now. So people see Desmond and Fowler sitting out there and they go, ah, here we go. Like, I circle Matt, you know, I put this circular-shaped block into this circular-shaped hole and this square-shaped block in the square-shaped hole and problem solved. And I get that, and there's appeal to that. I do kind of have that approach with Fowler where, hey, we need a guy who can be plus fielder and right or maybe play center and get on base. And, oh, look, there's one right here. How about that? But the Desmond thing, yeah, he may not even be an upgrade on Saladino, and he might cost you a lot.
For another org, you really wouldn't think that much about them punting the offense from a shortstop position for someone who can field it. But it's been such an anathema for the White Sox to have these guys who are just kind of justifying their existence solely through defense that Saladino's been this kind of player that I get irked seeing them play all the time because it reminds me of playing Gordon Beckham.
Brian Anderson,
and to some degree Tyler Flowers, so there's definitely a much stronger argument that Flowers was learned and adapted and developed skills that justified his presence. But it also seems like the reason that Tyler Flowers is out of the air this year is because the White Sox have made a concerted effort to kind of, you know, blast those guys out of their lineup. That's kind of the justification behind the Lurie acquisition, is that you don't want to have Carlos Sanchez just kind of tread water offensively and justify his existence as glove, and you don't want Tyler Flowers to, you know, weighted runs created 70-ish and try to make sure that his framing holds up. You want to try to plug more league average offense throughout the diamond. That makes, you know, a single Tyler Saladino player like that acceptable. But previous to the White Sox would have, you know, three or four guys who are, he's acceptable as a number nine hitter, but you can't bat them all ninth. But if there's really just one, you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do wonder, I'd love to see some numbers crunched on this. I have to think, I know that lineup protection for like an individual hitter has been sort of debunked. I think that was the, at least that's where I think that the wisdom stands on it now. But I do think there's only so many glove only dudes you can shove into a lineup before the whole thing breaks. And I do think that there is a cascading effect where if your lineup has three to six guys who are all getting on base at under at like 310 or lower, where your opposing pitching staff, your opponent is getting like six or seven innings out of their starter every freaking game, and they're always ahead, and then you're just like getting stomped on by their like best relievers every game, and you're never getting to pad your stats at all with getting the starter out in the fifth and then going out there at the back end of their bullpen. I do think that that adds up over the course of a season.
Certainly.
So, yeah, like you said, I mean, that was the traditional thing, is like you get offensive surplus at like a lot of positions, and then you can afford to carry Saladino's bat, theoretically.
I mean, I think it's better said about lineup protection the way we talk about clutch hitting. It's not measurable and it's not verifiable, but, you know, people in the game are talking about it constantly. I don't think the default position should always be to dismiss it out of hand and write off people as idiots. I mean, it could be a psychological thing. It could just be, you know, it makes your top hitters more comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, but there's no way that, I mean, we've seen what, you know, we talk about stress pitches and the difficulty of innings and times of the order penalty and wearing out your opposing pitcher. And if half the lineup is just like a breeze, then that's gonna, you know, they can save their max effort pitches for like the two threats in the lineup. And obviously they've lengthened the lineup quite well this offseason. Catcher should do as well or better on offense next year, depending on how you feel about those guys. Obviously third base and second base, you're getting better hitting. One hopes that Melky can do better than he did last year.
You can also show less stuff if you can just fire fastballs down the pipe against guys who can't drive it anywhere.
Yeah. See, I'm not crazy, right? Like that there's a disproportionate effect of having that many bad bats in the lineup beyond the fact that those dudes just can't hit, that it's going to start affecting the rest of how your team can do. Maybe I should like make Ethan figure that out with his numbers, but I think you can carry Saladino if you fix right field. I'm also interested along these same lines, you know, talking about the whole team and how they relate to each other and how they compare to last year. You pointed, I liked how you said in an article a couple months ago that the White Sox defense last year was quietly as bad as their offense was. And talking about the changes from last year and what other changes they might still make, I was thinking about whether or not their defense has meaningfully improved from last year. Obviously Frazier is like this quantum, will be like, should be a quantum leap of improvement at third base defensively. Laurie, I think, is probably below average at second, meaning he'd be like way better than Micah Johnson and worse than Sanchez defensively, I would think.
Probably.
I don't think Avila and Navarro are going to be as good defensively as Flowers was last year.
Not really a chance, no.
And other than that, you're looking at Saladino to improve on what Alexi did at short last year, and I have no idea. I don't know if he can do that or not. Obviously, Alexi wasn't as good as he had been before last year, but we don't really know what Tyler Saladino, full-time glove at shortstop, is going to look like in the majors, necessarily. So do you, like, if they don't do anything and write, like, did they get way better at third base defensively and, like, and another year older everywhere else?
You
also
had Saladino play a lot of third base defensively, and that's kind of, like, where the bulk of his value came from, is that he basically played pretty well there.
Yep.
And he was there for basically half the season. I mean, Connor Gillespie was abjectly terrible in his short period of time.
As was Old.
Oh, goodness gracious. I blocked that out. So it's kind of like a half-season strong upgrade, but I don't think it's like an entire worst unit in baseball type of switch.
And similarly, like I said, with this Laurie and Sanchez thing, like the only value you got out of Sanchez last year was his glove at second. So, you know, Abreu's the same. He's a year older. Melky's a year older. Eaton's a year older. I don't know. I mean, I don't know unless you really – maybe, like, if Alexi was really terrible at short last year, and Saladino's really good, I guess that makes a big difference. But I'm just not – I'm worried. I'm worried that, like, the defense is still going to be a huge issue next year.
We could try to blame it all on Avisail. We could say that he was, like, abjectly terrible and that he also sapped away from Eaton, who had to think more about shifting over and helping, and that Dexter Fowler would just be a huge upgrade.
Well, right, and that's assuming – like, if they add Fowler – if you replace Avisail's glove with Fowler, then yes, you have made like a huge improvement defensively. Certainly in right. So, but we don't know that they're going to do that. We don't know that they're going to do anything in right.
No, we don't. It's not a great time to feel guaranteed and certain.
And that's part of why I've talked myself into Austin Jackson being fine.
I really think his bat is toast, man.
I do too, but Avisail's bat is also toast. At least he can catch the ball. At least, like, a couple of those, like, flares to right field and those horrible Twins games with Sale on the mound would be caught by Austin Jackson instead of, like, kicked into foul territory by Avisail. If he even, like, made contact with it.
Yeah, there's that. What kind of deal are you getting Austin Jackson? Really not trying to, like, invest into multiple years of his bats to further decline.
No, I don't know. I mean, theoretically, if you're so super scared of signing anybody past, like, 2017, then, I don't know, offer him, like, 2 years and, like, $10 million and see if he takes it.
Should you really have to give him more than 1 year based on, like, where he is?
Well, who else is he – who's he blocking?
No one, but
– so who cares?
I don't know. You can pursue some other scrap heap veteran next year.
Okay, so one year, eight. He doesn't say no to that, does he?
Probably not.
So there you go. You can deal with this next year.
But then he's not very good.
No, but, like, dude, it's that or obviously or you trade, like, a bunch of stuff for a not cheap Andre Ethier. So, like... See, this is the thing. Like, if the White Sox are trying to, like, wait out Fowler to, like, bargain him down another $10 million or something, like, you know, kudos to them for trying to optimize or whatever and, like, maximize their leverage. But at a certain point, it's like, don't you have more to lose than Fowler does?
Yeah, now that Carlos Quinton's off the board.
I don't know. So those are some of the things that are worrying me. I'm trying to not just look at right field, but it's hard to, like, everything kind of comes back to it. Because even when I try to look at, okay, well, did they improve their defense from last year? Because that was a huge problem last year. Like, they were a disaster defensively. And you can look at, like, the gap between their pitchers' ERAs and, like, their FIPs, and you can look at their defensive efficiency last year.
I suppose you could spend some time worrying about the back end of the rotation if you wanted to.
Yeah, I just, you know, I don't know. Kyle Loesch kind of interests me. He was really bad last year, but...
Colby Rasmus is a free agent next year. That could be your scrap heap signing.
It just seems weird that, like, you would look at Saladino, Avisail, Danks and Eric Johnson and be like, yeah, we're gonna change everything except Avisail. Like, that's weird to me. That you're just operating on some sort of different reality than I am if that's what's happening. Do you know what I mean?
Well, he's also their baby. Like, he was the centerpiece of a major trade that was supposed to be the kick starting their rebuilding.
At this point,
certainly, like, they had some internal valuations that valued him very highly. So it might take a long time to reverse that kind of assessment.
Presumably, couldn't you just... I mean, at this point, it wasn't Montas the centerpiece? Like, really?
J.B. Wendelken was the centerpiece in my heart.
Oh, he's in Oakland now, right?
Yeah.
He went for Lori?
Mm-hmm. Hurts.
Did Detroit send anything... Oh, they sent Brian Villarreal, too. Because I was going to say, if the only reason Detroit was brought in was so because the White Sox wanted Avisail instead of Iglesias, I'm gonna have a hard time swallowing that one.
I'm glad it ended in a hard time because I thought you were about to say heart attack.
No, I don't think any of those are in my near future. But I don't know. I might have to watch another 600 plate appearances of Avisail again. So, no, to be continued.
Maybe put him at the top of the lineup. He could get 700.
Then he'd be a really good candidate for like a four horseman player in What If Sports, which would be really good.
Like a 2011 Juan Pierre season.
Oh, Oh, man. That's bleak. We can't end on that, can we?
What do you think of this offseason so far? Pretty good, right?
Well, it's just, it's, I guess it's in keeping with the White Sox, where this is something I've been saying for years now, where they do the hardest things really well. They do the hardest things with ease. And then they just, like, botch the easiest things to do so unbelievably badly that it just, like, torpedoes everything else. Because, like, this offseason, I was looking around, I was like, I think we all were. We're like, man, how are they going to fix, like, third and, like, get more offense at a catcher and second? Like, oh, man. And then they just did it, like, easily and cheaply. Todd, and then it's like, how do you go into this offseason needing
quarterback? Assuming that the Reds are not trading Joey Votto and he's not part of the rebuilding effort, especially with the Aroldis Chapman situation, Todd Frazier was their biggest trade chip by far. Mm-hmm. And the White Sox acquired him for bench players and a reliever.
Yeah. And like,
Trace Thompson is like number 15 on the Dodgers like outfield depth chart. Because there's so many damn many of those.
Yeah, that's another interesting scenario. I mean, I wonder how much of the easier thing is just people looking at the Dodgers and being like, you can't roster all these dudes. So like, there is a fit there. It is weird that the White Sox are going to like send them an outfielder and now are going to try to get one back who fits worse than the one that they just gave up. But, you know, it's so weird to me that you could like solve all those problems and still walk out of this offseason with like, you should have room in your budget for one of these like five or six outfielders who are like a massive upgrade on your weakest spot in your lineup now.
They got 2 years of a cost-controlled second baseman who hits league average for two guys who may not have made their top 10 list for prospects.
Oh, yeah.
One was not a great system.
One was a fourth-round pick, and then one was the third guy that they got in the, depending on what you think of Cluey Louie, was like the third guy they got for a year and a month of Jake Peavy. So, yeah.
I think Cluey Louie can't hit high A pitching, so.
I wish you could, if this were like basketball and you could sub every time, you know, sub in and out as many times as you want, he'd be amazing.
It's just weird, like, the tools, like, we focus so much on tools and prospect assessment, like, the point where we talk, like, excitedly about Cluey Louie, who was, like, as close as you can come to half of a baseball player. It's like if you had, like, a really great, like, pair of legs that ran around. That's basically, like, how functional Cluey Louie is.
Half a baseball player is still more than Abascal, though.
Ugh.
You know I'm right.
Like, Cluey Louie has, like, an 80 fielding tool, or 80 fielding, and, like, something below the scouting skill in terms of, like, hitting. Mm-hmm. Whereas Abascal has, like, everything turned up to 40. It's like every aspect of the game, he is just a bit below major league average at it.
Summy's like 35.
Well, now they've declined a bit.
Oh man. And I'd say, you know, it's like maybe they're banking on him like improving for next year. The only improvements I could see Abascal making would just be by virtue of like it's really hard to be as bad as he was last year. But Mike Musari's piece, pretty much confirmed my dread, which was that, like, this type of dude does not, you don't do what Abascal's done for the last few years and, like, come out of it.
He
like,
could try to steal bases less and improve that way.
That's true. He could do that. Pitchers are just going to start throwing out of the windup with him on first. And that's going to hurt whoever's hitting. There's no winning here.
Are there documented cases of pitchers doing that against Canerco in, like, his late 30s?
I would assume they did that in his late 20s. I remember getting really mad. I was playing, I was like, a midfielder playing soccer in high school at the time. This was, like, easily the best I could run in my life. I remember just being like, Dad, I'm, like, faster than Canerco, right? My dad's like, I don't know, he's a pro athlete. And I was like, if you can't come with me on this one, man, like, I don't know if you love me. Like, I don't know. I know I can. He did agree with me that I could throw better than Johnny Damon, so I got that out of him.
I don't recall a lot of memories of Daryl Hamilton, rest his soul, throwing. like in person, but I remember that his AAA or triple play, like 99 player, like his throws from center field, like bounced six times every time I played like the Astros.
Well, you've seen the Raul Ibañez like lawn darts, right?
Yes.
I don't know if Ibañez was consistently terrible at throwing, but some of those were great. Damon, it just looked like something had like happened to his, like he had some sort of injury to his arm that prevented him from throwing. I don't know if that's the case, but one of the worst throwing arms I have ever seen.
Ben Revere bouncing a throw in from like left for a walk-off White Sox winner in like 2011 was probably the high point of that season.
Lillibridge was like the high point.
All right. Thrillibridge in New York, of course.
Yeah. My parents were at that game.
Maybe they should bring back Thrillibridge.
I think there's still, if they sign Fowler, what, and do nothing else, what is your, like, just off the cuff prediction for next year and or off-season grade?
Off-season grade is probably a B to B plus. I think they should get like full marks for recognizing their situation correctly and building to position the team for the win in the next 2-3 years. And I think the trades that they pulled off, especially Todd Frazier, was just, you know, wizardry.
Yep.
But I think at some point, I mean, it's blatantly clear that they wanted to sign a bigger, better corner outfielder, and you can acknowledge the factors that led to them not doing it, but it's ultimately a failure. Like, something that irritates me, or kind of a pet peeve, is people kind of like making the defense of, I'm not mad at the front office, or, you know, you can't hate the front office. The front office is not my kid. I don't think like they messed up in school. I'm trying to assess like how successful they were, or how competitive a team they built. Like, they lost out on targets to other teams. Or they, like, that's a charitable definition. Like, I could say they didn't seriously pursue them at all, but I'm giving them credit that they pursued them and they didn't get them. Like, the fact that there were, like, natural disadvantages in place that they couldn't overcome, yeah, that's unfortunate, and yeah, maybe you don't lower your assessment of Rick Hahn for it, but it didn't go well. Like, it wasn't a positive thing for the franchise. Yeah. So, yes, it's like, that lowers the conception of, like, what the offseason was. It was not as successful as they intended it to be, or as we hoped it would be. Like, no, I think Rick Hahn is really good, and the White Sox are well served to have him trying to make their team better, but this wasn't an ideal result.
No, and like saying, oh, well, you can't be mad at the front office or whatever it is. He goes by Bob Shabazz on Twitter. Justin pointed this out in the wake of the Justin Upton signing, was like the team that needed a corner outfielder more than any other team in the form of the White Sox just watched their division rivals sign two of the three best, like one of whom didn't even really like need it that badly. Now they have Justin Upton. So
yeah, and whole like not being in on Justin Upton thing is fine. Like the fact that they zeroed in on Yoenis Cespedes and Alex Gordon, that's fine if that's what their internal evaluations is. Now that you didn't wind up with either one of those guys, not being in on Justin Upton doesn't seem as good of a decision. How does it?
No, and he's almost certainly going to opt out in 2 years. Like, so you're not even, you wouldn't even be like on the hook for that much. I mean, yes, opt outs are very player friendly. And if Justin Upton, I don't know, it gets hit by a bus the minute after he signs the contract, like, you're on the hook for, like, $132 million. But, like, that's not...
Jeez, you think you have insurance for that sort of thing?
Well, sure, you're right. But, like, Justin Upton is, like, a very low-risk proposition. And if you're scared of doing that deal, then why are you... Like, then quit and let somebody else buy the team who isn't scared of that. Because, like, if you weren't willing to do that, if you come this far with building a team and saying, we're competing this year... What's the point of stopping there? That's so weird to me. And, you know, you say, well, here, we're going to try for this year, next year. And I do think the White Sox should have, moving forward, plan their competitive cycle more carefully, engage it a little bit more accurately than they have in the past. But at the same time, I would like them to try to make the playoffs more than, like, 1 year.
I'd like them to try to build something that could be good for, like, I don't know, 2 to 4 years, maybe. Maybe make the playoffs twice in, like, a 5-year span. Like, they've made the playoffs 4 times in my life. They average 1 playoff appearance every 7 years in my lifetime. Like, is that like the goal?
It can't be, because that type of situation is not going to allow you to invest, like, healthily. Like, you're not going to be able to build up this attendance base that you're constantly talking about as needing to be in place in order to kind of, like, make longer-term free agent risk if every year is just kind of like a 40% chance roll of the dice.
Yeah.
Your hit rate's just not going to be that good.
Oh, man. This is brutal. Colin just retweeted this. It's an image. It's a graph of from 2011 to 2015 in the American League, number of seasons where a player had 400-plus plate appearances and less than negative 0.5 FWAR seasons. The White Sox have 10. Nobody else has more than 4. The Rays have 0. The Angels have 0. The Blue Jays have... A bunch of teams have 1. There's 2 teams that had 4, 2 teams that had 3, and nobody else has had more than 2, and the White Sox have had 10.
So, yeah, if we were looking to pinpoint where our natural aversion to, oh, we'll just punt this lineup spot and the rest of the lineup be okay strategy, I would think this would be kind of where it starts.
Years of agony are my aversion to that. We're well over an hour at this point. We haven't even talked about Carson Palmer.
He's good.
Yeah, I just, like, if some people think he could be amazing and some people are like, well, he might be a reliever, and the White Sox, of all organizations, decided we think he could be a really good starter, then, like, who am I to second-guess the White Sox on that eval?
Yeah, it's funny what is, like, just beyond the shadow of the doubt about this organization and what we just harp on, like, immediately. But Fulmer is definitely in the former territory. Well,
like I said, man, they knock the hardest stuff to do out of the park, and then they just, like, they can't even color inside the lines on the easiest thing. So
it's like, for the rest of the league, people talk about tin staff, and there's no such thing as a pitching prospect. You can never trust them. White Sox draft a guy who could be a reliever and think he's going to be a starter around next season.
He's going to be a number 2 starter within the next 12 months, like worst case scenario. And then, like, but meanwhile, it's like we've devoted the most free agent dollars we have in years to, like, a left fielder and a DH, and we get a combined, like, 0 wins above replacement out of the 2 of them combined.
Like, you got less.
Yeah, between LaRoche and Melky, yeah, probably. It's just, it's unbelievable. They can't find a right fielder who isn't, like, the worst in baseball. Give us 10 years, we might get one.
What a team.
What a team. Carson, I'm looking forward to Carson Fulmer losing a lot of games 2-1.
So is he. he doesn't realize it, but he is.
Anything else you wanted to throw in there before we call it a day? I don't know if is it just that the offseason is incomplete and Rick Hahn has indicated that they feel that way too?
Yeah,
and
we're in this waiting period.
And it's just that there's only so many options left that we're getting to the point where they're like, the only rumor we're hearing is that they're kicking the tires on Andre Ethier. Maybe all it is them calling and being like, hey, L.A., like, will you give us this guy for free before his 10-5 rights kick in? In which case, like, you know, if the Dodgers want to cover 2/3 of his salary in return for, I don't know, freaking Avisale or whatever, you know, like, whatever's lying around, then, okay, that's not how I would solve the problem. But that's a scenario where Ethier could be interesting and improve the team. If it's because they'd rather spend $40 million and trade close to major league talent for Andre Ethier and try to, like, you know, have a horrible Frankenstein's monster of a roster again, instead of spending $10 to $20 million more on Dexter Fowler and losing one draft pick, then I think they're being dumb.
It's just so hard to focus on the positive things they've done while this loose hand is just staring me in the face.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
It's like, I've ordered the pizza, I've watched them make it on like a little online track or something. I know it's on delivery. How happy can I really be about the process until it's actually in my home?
That's a kind analogy, because that implies that the pizza is coming, and I'm just really worried that...
Well, maybe I live in a bad apartment complex, and someone's going to mug the pizza guy while he's walking up my stairs.
Maybe. I'm also really worried that they're gonna spin this as like, well, don't worry, we'll like add something at the deadline. Because, and I've seen people say it, it's like, oh, just I don't want to sign Fowler. I don't think he's that great. They can just add something to the deadline. Then, like, once again, you're talking about trading talent instead of money, which I think is foolish, especially when there's no reason for me to believe that they don't have at least some money to spend. And
you're talking about sucking for half the season.
Exactly. You're talking about, like, putting an anchor around the neck of the team at right field for more than half of the season and then hoping that there's, like, a solution there. So...
Why are you mad? They addressed the right field situation in the post-waiver August period.
I'm blanking. What are you referring to?
Like, you know, adding at the deadline could be as late as, like, August
28th. Oh, yeah. Like, just for September. And what bothers me is, like, what happens if you are, like, two and a half game? They were at July 31st this year, weren't they, like, 2.5 out of the wild card?
Probably, because who was out of the wild card by more than, like, 5 games other than the A's all season?
Yeah, I mean... So, what happens if you're there and you're, like, too scared to go for it again because, like, you don't think your team's that great, and you would have been maybe, you know, 2 or 3 games ahead of where you are at that point because you refused to address it before then, and that's also feeding your decision to not go for it. Like, it hits from 2 angles, and then we're looking at, like, you know... 8+ years without going to the playoffs? It's
too long.
Yeah. I'd like them to go to the playoffs again before I, like, start having children.
I'd like them to go to the playoffs before, like, they can build a Sox Fest panel around the 10-year anniversary of the last White Sox playoff team.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
And bring back, like, Jason Bourgeois to, like, talk to fans.
And also just, like, getting in the door and being able to throw, like, Sale and Quintana and Rodon at people, like, and if you run into like if you get matched up with a team that really depends on their lefties, like, you could eviscerate them, and then hey, you're in the ALCS, or like maybe you're in the World Series.
So like the Cleveland Indians,
didn't they just add Napoli and Rajay Davis?
Yes, but. I will die on the hill of not being afraid of those guys in 2016.
And Kipnis and Lindor, both right. Oh no, Kipnis best lefty. What am I talking about?
Yeah, I think I was only basing my statement around Kipnis.
Oh, I see. Well, Lindor's a switch hitter, so you don't know what you're talking about, James.
They used to be crazy lefty centric. I know it's changed over the years.
Oh, well, but that's why they carried, like, Ryan Rayburn to, like, ruin everyone's lives.
They're going to add him. I mean, he's just still floating around, dangerous. Brantley's left-handed.
He doesn't have much of a platoon split, though, does he? I mean, that dude just, like, never strikes out.
Let's test that against Chris Sale. I'm open to doing that.
Okay. I mean, I'm willing to, you know, if the season ends with, like, Michael Brantley, like, getting a hit off of Chris Sale in, like, the ALCS or something, like, whatever. That's fine.
I don't think that's what I'll say at the moment.
No, but you know what I mean. If the White Sox lost to the Indians in the ALCS, like, next year, if I could tell you that that's, like, what would happen, wouldn't you be, like, looking forward to that season?
Yes.
Yeah, Brantley's still a 705 OPS against lefties.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think Sale could take him, but... Okay. Well, do you want to chat again if... at the next White Sox transaction, or
sure, let's break here and toast to the White Sox eventual ALCS loss to the Cleveland Indians. It's going to be great.